Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Cape Wind inches closer to becoming America's first offshore wind farm as they announce a $600 million loan. But critics fight on. Cape Wind President Jim Gordon joins us in the studio. Then Callie Crossley goes above and under the radar to talk naming rights at the T and America 2 years after Trayvon. And then the Globe's Alex Beam on open mic talking magic at Whole Foods and what it's like to be a weather geek.
So how would you feel about taking the green line, not to Park Street, but to number 9 Park Street Station, then switching to the red line for Sam Adams Alewife Station? Well, get ready. The T wants to sell station names to the highest corporate bidders. Then Innovations Hub Karen Miller looks at great women innovators. It's a short list. And we'll ask you for your nominees. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Hi, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Well, good. So Cape Wind, the wind farm plan for Nantucket Sound, has gotten a major wind fall. While opponents have no plans to surrender, with a new $600 million loan, apparently, the project becomes closer to reality. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about all things Cape Wind, and take your calls in a few minutes, too, by the way, is its president, Jim Gordon. Jim, it's been a long time. Good to see you.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Very well. Shake my hand.
Hi,
and there
Marjorie.
He is.
A long time. I feel like we first talked with you about Cape Wind when I was about 12 years old.
Yes.
Yeah. So it is now 2014. Where are we in terms of Cape Wind happening, and what are the roadblocks still to get over from your perspective?
Well, Marjorie, this project has been in development for 13 years,
yep.
Lucky 13, and we're fully permitted. We were the first offshore wind farm permitted in the United States. We got the first offshore wind lease from the Department of Interior. So we're fully permitted. We have our lease. We have our contracts, equipment, supply put together. We are now putting our financing together. There are a couple of remaining obstacles. As you know, we have a opposition group that has filed more than 15 lawsuits against this project. We've won every single one of them so far. Recently, the FAA upheld their approval of our project. So we're marching forward and trying to bring this important project to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
You know, this morning I was reading some background pieces, Jim, because I haven't seen you in a couple of years. And they quote you in the last few years saying, next year we break ground, next year we break ground. What's the reality? Obviously, it's important for you, whether you believe it or not. I'm not questioning whether you do, but whether you do or not, it's obviously important for investors and others to keep the ball moving. What is the practical reality with a handful of lawsuits still pending? That sort of thing. What's the practical reality in terms of, I was going to say groundbreaking, I guess it's not groundbreaking, whatever, getting some construction done and turbines in Nantucket Sound?
The practicality is very good. I mean, literally, we have one consolidated lawsuit in Washington, D.C., which we're waiting for a decision from a federal district court judge. Those briefs have been in since last August, and we expect that decision, hopefully, any day now. Recently, on the very day we won, our FAA was upheld. The Alliance instituted another meritless lawsuit.
It's the Alliance for Nantucket Sound, which is the lead organization that's been fighting this.
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
We expect to file a motion to dismiss in that lawsuit very quickly. The Attorney General is defending the DPU on that. And it's really a meritless case. And look, when somebody files, 13, 14, 15 lawsuits against a project and they lose every one, there comes a time, one would hope, when they just say, look, we fought the good fight, and we're hoping that we can move this project forward soon.
Our number, by the way, if you want to speak to Jim Gordon, ask him questions, pose issues that matter to you about this, is 877-301-8970.
A couple of things, Jim. You know, in full disclosure, you know this. My sister Elizabeth, whom I love very much, of course, is not filing the lawsuits, but she's one of the people that's upset about the wind farm coming. And it's not really that much about the view, the whole story about the Kennedys not wanting their view ruined anymore. As you know, people on the Cape already pay huge electric bills. Almost every time the wind goes above 30 miles an hour, they lose their power. They're going to pay higher electric costs when the farm comes in. And there's also an upsetness about the jobs that many people thought were coming to the Cape, which is struggling now in the wintertime. A lot of poor people on the Cape in the wintertime. Those jobs are going overseas. Even that welder in Middleborough that was hoping he was going to make a lot of money building part of your wind farms, that's not going to happen. So what about the cost
Sure.
and the jobs?
Well, that's a good question, Marjorie. And I'll tell you, today the cost of electricity in Massachusetts and New England is about $250 a megawatt hour or 25 cents a kilowatt. Today, if Cape Wind was operating, the price would be about 19 cents. So here in New England, we have a situation where we're short on capacity Yeah. because all these old coal-fired plants are getting retired. We're heavily dependent. About 50% of our power is generated with natural gas. Where's the price of natural gas going to be in the next 10 years? I don't know, okay? But I can tell you one thing. In power pools that have put a lot of wind on their system, in Texas, in Germany, in other parts of the world, the price of electricity has gone down. And the reason being is because wind displaces a more heavily polluting, more expensive unit that uses fossil fuel. So I can tell you that Cape Wind, over the life of its contract, and the reason that the Department of Public Utilities approved the NSTAR and the National Grid contracts was because they saw that this project would be in the public interest, not only in terms of a healthier environment, mitigating climate change, but also in stabilizing electricity costs.
But two things, though. You talked about the prices of electricity in Massachusetts in general. Cape Cod is paying higher than that right now. Right?
Cape Cod is, today it's paying higher than that.
And afraid they're going to be paying even more.
They're not, because our prices are contractually set.
Okay.
Our rate is 19 cents. It escalates at 3.5% a year. So we're a long-term hedge against volatile fossil fuel costs, tightening environmental regulations, maybe CO2 taxes. All of these things Cape Wind avoids because we avoid the external costs of burning fossil fuels, and we also help stabilize electricity costs in New England. And that's a big misnomer that people, the opposition has done a good job of constantly saying that this is a high-priced power, it's going to raise the price of electricity, but outside economic experts and the DPU have concluded a very different story.
Is it just on stay on course for one second before we get to the jobs issue? Are you saying, Jim Gordon, that in the short run, your position, just so I understand it, in the short run, a power generated through your enterprise will cost more, but in the long run, based upon trends, you're projecting that it will cost less? Is that a fair characterization of where you are?
That is a fair characterization, Jim, but there's also something you have to also understand, and energy economics are complex. There's something called price suppression. And that is when you put a zero fuel cost energy resource into the power grid, it reduces the clearing price, and all kilowatts in that hour get paid the clearing price. So would you pay a premium on 2% of something if it was going to lower the other 98% of the cost?
I'm listening. No, go ahead.
So that's essentially it. Two things. Yes, we believe that ultimately the price of fossil fuels will be higher over the long term than wind. Obviously, wind is zero cost, and it stays that way. But also, there are very direct benefits in influencing the price of electricity by even putting in a higher cost wind resource into the grid.
You know, Marjorie mentioned the jobs issue. And by the way, we are going to take your calls in a second for Jim Gordon at 877-301-8970. You can speak directly to the head, the guy behind, and the head of Cape Wind. One of your biggest supporters is Deval Patrick. And when Deval Patrick came out against this, he had to oppose one of his biggest supporters, who was Ted Kennedy at the time, who was an opponent of this. In 2010, when he was running for re-election, Governor Patrick went to this press event with some local manufacturers. This agreement between Cape Wind, and then he names two local companies, will create hundreds of new manufacturing jobs in Massachusetts as we take the lead on offshore wind energy in the United States. Obviously, talking about your project. The turbines are going to be built by, from what I read, a German company in Denmark. Mm-hmm. Most of your funding is from Denmark. So what do you say to those that who say, you promised, you and the governor promised a lot of Massachusetts jobs, but essentially they're foreign jobs that are going to be funded?
Well, let me say this. You know, Governor Patrick has great vision when it comes to clean energy. And as you know, Jim, the clean energy sector in Massachusetts is one of the fastest growing job catalysts in the Commonwealth, okay? So there's all kinds of companies working on clean energy.
And by the way, it matters a lot to one of his close friends, Barack Obama, too. I don't mean Cape Wind as such, but clean energy sources high on his priority as well.
There's no question, and the Commonwealth is benefiting from that today. The reality is that, look, and relative to that manufacturer in Middleborough, we introduced them to the company in Germany that's going to build this. And they were looking at the feasibility of possibly building a plant in Massachusetts. The reality is that, Jim, this project has been held up for 12 years now, so that when investors look, they want to see a pipeline of offshore wind projects that would necessitate building the supply chain in New England. Nobody would want a supply chain here more than the industry, because rather than transporting these 400-ton monopile foundations across the Atlantic Ocean, having a supply chain will happen as the industry progresses and there are more projects in the pipeline.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking with Jim Gordon from Cape Wind. They have a big, exciting news event where they got a $600 million loan to get them closer to becoming or investor to get them closer to building this plant off of Cape Cod. You know, one last question before we get to the phones. I know you're the first, or you will be the first, in the water wind farm in the United States. Are there other in the water wind farms elsewhere?
There are over 60 operating offshore wind farms in Europe and in Asia. So this is not a new technology.
Okay.
The Danes have been doing this since 1991, and that first offshore wind farm is still operating today.
What percentage of Danish electricity is, roughly, I don't mean percent, is supplied by wind power? Do you know?
Right now they get over 25% of their energy from wind power, and they also expect by the year 2050 to probably get over 50% of their energy from offshore and land-based wind. But can I just say one thing?
Because the reason I asked that is the emails are all about the fish and the birds and the whales, et cetera.
And I'll address that point. But it's important to understand that when Cape Wind starts construction, that project is going to be being built by union labor that we've worked together with for a long time to build that project, okay? So there's going to be hundreds of people, you know, operating in the South Coast area building this project. There will also be American suppliers of various things as well. So there's going to be a lot of jobs, and there are 58,000 people now in Europe working in the offshore wind industry.
Our number is 877-301-8970 if you'd like to talk about Cape Wind and its imminent construction. You know, I've seen all the pictures about how it's going to look from shore, but I've never thought about how it's going to look or what is even going to happen while it's being built. What are you going to do? Have boats out there with the workers on them?
And,
and how long is it going to take?
No, Marjorie, they're going to swim out with the turbines.
Oh, would you stop it? I mean, you know, I mean, the vision.
They're a little heavy to swim with.
But what is it going to be? Is it going to be massive?
It's going to be a 30-month construction program.
Uh-huh.
There will be vessels out there.
It's going to swim
The project is built under very tight regulations. We have a lease with the Department of Interior, many requirements to follow.
What kind of boats? Are they going to be like tankers or what?
They'll be barges with cranes on them that will lift the monopiles off the barges and hammer them into the ocean floor so that the wind turbines can be put on top of them. There'll be vessels that will be laying the undersea cable to transport the electricity to the grid. And you know, that's an important thing to also realize, that Cape Wind's power also includes the transmission costs.
Yep.
So when people talk about, you know, the price of hydroelectricity or the price of natural gas coming in here, you have to build transmission lines. The beauty of offshore wind is we have highly densely populated coastal areas that need energy. They need clean energy because it's a low-lying coastal community and it's subject to the impacts of climate change. So this you can plug and play where the energy is needed with an inexhaustible resource.
So one last thing, we'll get to the phones because Jim is giving me the high sign here. The number,
well,
by the way,
have been waiting here.
They have been, and we'll get to them in a second, 877-301-8970. But it, obviously, at least for those 30 months, the people that are worried about the ultimate view are going to be very unhappy with the barges out there, and the fish are going to have to take off for at least a while, correct? They're not going to be sitting there while you're hammering into the ground or swimming around. I guess the fish don't sit down, do they, Jim?
Well, I'm sure fish will swim away from the construction area, but you know, this has been carefully looked at. We had 17 federal and state agencies, and it was a 10-year permitting process. So when the wind farm is built, the fish will come back. They're actually attracted by the artificial reef-like effects of the monopile foundations. Even our data tower out in Nantucket Sound, you know, there's a lot of fish. That's one of the best fishing spots in the sound.
Okay.
Let's go to the calls. 877-301-8970. Jim Gordon, head of Cape Wind, is here for you. Bob, you're in New Rochelle, New York, of all places. Welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hey, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a question about, because I'm all for green energy. I'm from New Hampshire. I'm going to school in New York. But there's a huge impact on birds, especially migratory birds, with wind turbines, both land and in the sea. So I guess with Nantucket in specific, like, what's going to be the impact with birds? Like, is it a path that many birds take, and how has that been factored into the studies?
Bob, thanks for the question.
That's a great question, Bob. And I can tell you that the Mass Audubon Society, which, you know, is the organization that really looks at protecting birds, has followed the regulatory process, participated in it for the past decade. They did their own research with our ornithologists, and they're supporting Cape Wind. And the reason that they're supporting Cape Wind is that they believe, and the studies show, that there will not be a negative impact on bird populations. But more importantly, if Cape Wind is displacing pollution and helping to mitigate climate change is the biggest threat to birds and wildlife. And that's why Mass Audubon, as well as Conservation Law Foundation, Greenpeace, Sierra Club, and all the major environmental organizations are supporting the Cape Wind Project, including the National Wildlife Association.
Let's go to Jill. You're in Plymouth. You're on with Jim Gordon. He's the president of Cape Wind. Welcome, Jill.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say, I was on a flight from Norway back to the U.S., and we flew over Denmark and could look down at the water and see the turbines. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful.
You know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but I can tell you that.
I love that, by the way. I love that one, Jim.
It was a great line.
I mean, the fact is that in Europe, offshore wind farms have become tourist attractions where boat tours take people out.
Someone in Aruba.
And I have a vision. In fact, we're going to be working with Highline Cruises, which initially was an opponent to the offshore wind farm. But when they went through the regulatory process and saw that it would not have a negative impact on navigation.
They go to Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard.
Right. What they want to do is set up eco tours to take, you know, schools out, field trips, tourists visiting that will want to go out and sail through the wind farm.
Hey, Jill, thank you for the call. You know, when I first met you, when, as Marjorie said, when she was a child, when this project started and we started doing interviews, Jim Gordon, maybe a decade or so ago, what I would ask you every time, I'll ask you a decade later, is when most of the objections I thought at the time, whether I was right or not is almost irrelevant, was about the visuals. It's sort of, remember Mitt Romney's line, you don't put a wind farm in the Grand Canyon. I found that pretty compelling, frankly. And I'd always say to you, well, why can't you move it further out? So you get your goal. It's a little more expensive, admittedly, but you know, at least the vision is not the issue. And I believe your response at the time, for the most part, was, well, the technology is not really there. Well, it's a decade later. Isn't it? I know you've done a huge amount of planning over a long period of time, but if you were to decide to do the project from scratch today, you would have the ability to do it far further out, would you not? Which would at least alleviate the concerns of those who are worried about the sight lines, which, I mean, it is, as you say, some think it's beautiful, like Jill, some think it's not beautiful at all. You would have the ability to do it if you started today, wouldn't you?
There's no question that in Europe they are taking the offshore wind turbines out farther and in deeper waters. But remember, they've had over 20 years experience doing that. It's critically important that for the first wind farms in America, we do them where you're going to have the chance for the most success, where you have a learning curve, you go up the learning curve, and you make the project a big success. You know, we've gone through a long permitting process, Jim. If we started all over, you know, there would be people and, you know, you're never going to make...
No, I'm not suggesting. I'm asking. Yeah. I'm just asking about the state of the technology. But the answer is, if you were starting today, and believe me, I'm not giving anybody any advice about anything, the technology that didn't exist a decade ago does exist. So if there was Cape Wind 2, for example, if you get this thing built, then in theory, you'd have the ability to do it far further out and at least get rid of that opposition, correct? Is that a fair statement?
That's correct. Okay. But I do want to answer your question that if I knew what I knew today, we would still locate the project on Horseshoe Shoal because it is the optimum site to build America's first offshore wind farm.
What do you know? Every once in a while, Marjorie and I talk about you because we see your name in the paper. We've both spent a lot of time talking to you. What do you do every day? I mean, this has been such a long, and I know securing huge loans and dealing with critics and lawsuits. I mean, I was saying to Marjorie yesterday, the guy's going to become a greeter at Mohegan Sun in his spare time. I mean, I'm serious. This is whether people love you or hate you. It's been 12 years of your life with an idea that I know you care about deeply. What do you do all the time?
Yesterday, I spoke at an offshore wind conference in Europe where hundreds of people from Europe and all over the world came in, and they're looking at Massachusetts as becoming the hub of the offshore wind industry in North America, thanks to the Patrick administration's vision and Secretary Sullivan. Saturday, I'll be the keynote speaker at the Yale Environmental Law Conference. I guess they want to meet a guy who's had 20 lawsuits filed against him.
So it's all Cape Wind all the time is the answer.
No, it isn't.
Or all wind power all
the
time.
No, it isn't.
What is it?
We've built two of the nation's largest biomass facilities, one in Texas and one in Florida. I have three beautiful children. I spend a lot of time with them. You know, I think I lead a pretty balanced life, but I'll tell you one thing. I'm very passionate about this project. That's probably an understatement because I do believe that climate change and energy independence are two challenges that we have got to face.
Quickly, before we get back to the calls, where are Baker and the leading Democrats and, let's say, Jeff McCormick on Cape Wind? Do you know?
Well, I saw in the editorial board the other day at the Standard Times down in New Bedford, he said it was a done deal.
Baker?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know exactly where he stands.
But do you know if you have any opponents amongst the leading contenders?
I don't think we have any opponents in the leading contenders.
By the way, speaking of opponents, we are getting emails about where are the opponents, and we intend to have the people that are on the other side of this issue in here very soon, since we have given all this time to Jim Gordon. Let's go to Kathy on the South Shore. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Yeah, I think Cape Wind is a great idea. And my only concern is the disintegration of the towers over time, and I was wondering if you could address that.
Thank you, Kathy.
Kathy, the monopile foundations in the towers will have about a 30-year life. So, you know, they're coated with the state-of-the-art corrosion protection materials. And what we're going to do is we're going to have people on our operations and maintenance team operating out of Falmouth Harbor. We're buying a marina in Falmouth, and we'll have a staff of about 50 people that will be, you know, maintaining and operating the offshore wind farm over its useful life. At the end of the project contract and at the end of our lease, we'll have a choice as to whether or not we replace the wind turbines with the next generation of the state-of-the-art nacelles and blades, or we will decommission the facility and you won't know it was there.
Thanks for the call.
Speaking of Falmouth and decommissioning, you heard these stories down in Falmouth. They were pretty scary stories about residents there that had wind towers right next to them, not on the water, but sort of outside their backyards. One Vietnam vet, terrible stories about the health problems it's caused. And the town voters said we're not going to take them down despite these health problems because it was going to cost them, I believe the number was $13 million mm-hmm. to take down two towers. So when eventually these towers do have to come down, in Falmouth, the taxpayers were on the hook. Why are the taxpayers not going to be in the hook in Barnstable County?
Well, because we have a decommissioning fund that we're required by law to fund. And secondly, Marjorie, your point is very well taken. And that's one of the reasons that we're bringing the wind turbines offshore. I don't know the exact situation in Falmouth, but I'll tell you, our wind turbines are going to be over 5 miles from the nearest resident. You won't hear them. You will barely see them. They'll be about a quarter of an inch off the horizon. It'll have to be a very clear day for you to see them. You'll have to come out on an eco tour to really experience the majestic experience of sailing amongst these.
By the way, is it the implication in a Globe, short Globe story this morning is you are responsible for getting the head of your lead opponent disinvited from a wind conference. Is that true?
Me?
You, yeah, you know?
Me? I'll tell you one thing.
Not guilty?
The way this opposition group has gone after the offshore wind industry, I know there's a lot of people in this industry that did not want her there.
Okay, fair enough. Sheila, you're in Needham. You're on with Jim Gordon. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, how are you, Jim and Marjorie?
We are excellent.
Mr. Gordon.
Hi.
My question is, with all of the technology expertise in the United States and particularly in the Northeast, why can't consultants come over from Denmark and work with people here in the United States, in Massachusetts, train them and have the building of the massive pieces that are going to support this wind farm done right here in the United States, in Massachusetts, and provide jobs?
Sheila,
that's
great question.
The key. That's the key. We need jobs in Massachusetts. And for that to go overseas, and if I lived on the Cape, I would be very much against it.
Sheila, thanks for the call. Jim?
Sheila, that's exactly what's going to happen. Obviously, the experience and the technology resides in Europe now, and the Europeans will come over. They will work with their American counterparts on the Cape Wind project to impart their lessons learned and their experience to try to make it as smooth a project as possible. The more offshore wind farms we do here, it's like any other emerging industry. You've got to get the experience, go through the learning curve. There'll be more jobs. As economies of scale pick up, the cost of offshore wind will drop dramatically as it did in the solar industry. And that's what we're trying to do. But if you hold up projects through frivolous litigation and through, you know, fear-mongering or propaganda, that doesn't help us get on that ladder to create the kind of jobs that you're looking for.
You know, Jim, I'm sorry, Marjorie.
What about these jobs in Maine? I'm getting emails about some big, massive project of yours that's in Maine, not in Massachusetts. What's that?
Well, Siemens is charged with manufacturing the electric service platform. That's where all the electricity is collected from these turbines, and then it's transmitted through high-voltage cables to the grid in Barnstable. So Siemens is looked all around to try to find a spot that they could build it. Thankfully, they're building it in the United States and not in Europe. So, you know, they saw what fabrication yard was available, what contractor would take the schedule penalties that were necessary.
So
for
they're
them
better
to build
equipped
it.
In Maine than in Massachusetts. But you have to get why, if you're living on Cape Cod, you've lived there all your life. You're a fisherman. You're someone that relies on tourism. You run a hotel. You can barely pay your bills as it is. This is really scary because it looks like that they're going to hold the bag in terms of the cost, and they're not going to get the rewards. You know, what are people that live in Osterville or Hyannis, which is pretty poor in the wintertime, going to get out of this?
You know, Marjorie, that's an interesting question. And think of it this way. Some of these people are the same people that are doing everything they can to throw themselves in front of this project
right.
to stop them. So now they're asking, well, gee, why aren't we creating jobs here on Cape Cod? Well, the answer is, over the past 12 years, we've probably had 1 million man hours of scientists, designers, engineers, ornithologists from the local region, you know, putting this project through its paces,
yep.
through the permitting thing. The project has got to go forward so that we can begin to create the jobs that policymakers see that this industry can really produce.
But yeah, try to characterize what you're saying, Jim, and we'll take one or two quick additional calls before Jim has to go. Forget those who are just passionate supporters and passionate opponents.
Right.
Let's talk about the great middle that just wants to know what the deal is. What you seem to be saying on the two things that Marjorie's broached, both jobs and ultimate rates, is trust me. You seem to be saying, yeah, in the short term, we're not going to be able to do the manufacturing jobs here, but as the industry develops, we will. We're not going to be able to provide lower energy rates in the short term, but in the long run, especially with fossil fuel costs and that sort of thing, we will. That's a leap for people. Would you not agree? I mean, you're a pretty smart guy. If you were in the middle on a project and the leader of it said, you really just have to trust me on these two critical issues, you can understand how people have some skepticism, can't you?
Absolutely can. But, you know, unless we put steel in the water and start to catalyze this industry, we all know that there will not be any jobs. What we're trying to do is we're trying to tap the experienced local people in this region that can do the work with our European counterparts that have the experience. Same thing happened in the onshore wind business, Jim. You know, the Europeans captured the lead on that. Then all of a sudden, land-based wind started to take off. We don't have those land areas in New England. That's why we're going offshore. But then people started to build factories in the United States to make components for land-based wind. And right now, Siemens has probably 30,000 people working in the United States doing energy projects on land. And they've set up an office in Boston, the North American headquarters for offshore wind.
We only have time to squeeze in one more quick one. Eric, you're in Maine. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Eric. Quickly, if you can, please.
Good afternoon. I find it amazing the differences between the Keystone Pipeline and all the complaining about that and all the people that are for it. And then you look at clean energy, something like this, and the people that are for it and against it. It's really compelling to think about the reasons why each group is for and against each project. It's such a political division.
And what conclusions do you draw, Eric?
It's all about the jobs, but with the Keystone, there's such a potential for an environmental, catastrophe, coming from one environmental catastrophe, piping oil down to potential another one just to get it out in the world market to be paying for the same price. That it doesn't do anything to the price for us when we can have clean energy off of the Cape for years to come, and creating just as many jobs, maybe. I don't know. It drives me crazy, the argument.
Eric, that's a good observation. And if you look at the opposition group to the Cape Wind project, the major funder of the opposition group is a coal billionaire and petroleum coke producer. So, you know, clearly he owns waterfront property in the Cape and Islands, but he is very involved in the fossil fuel industry.
And by the way, we know we've got an email. We will have the other side in, as we always have. Hey, Jim Gordon, it's great to see
you.
It's been a long time. Hope to see you again soon.
That's right.
Take care.
It's good that we're all growing old together here, Jim Gordon. Okay.
This is keeping me young.
Jim Gordon is the president of Cape Wind. They've recently secured a significant portion of the money they need to bring Cape Wind to fruition. Jim, thanks again for being with us. Up next, Callie Crossley joins us for her take on the latest news, from the MBTA name game to Trayvon Martin. It's been 2 years since he was killed. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This week on Radiolab.
I lie down, I close my eyes, and I fell asleep.
Both Shakespeare and Cervantes referred to sleep as death.
Danger, danger, danger.
Quit, Mart. You're dreaming. You're hurting me.
Why do we sleep?
Why do we dream?
It's a mystery. Tired. Everybody does it, from the cradle to the grave.
I'm tired.
And we don't know why? That's a shameful state of affairs.
Tonight at 10, here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Boston Ballet, presenting Close to Chuck, a trio of contemporary dance with a tribute to artist Chuck Close and composer Philip Glass, featuring works from Killian, Ello, and Martinez. Now through March 3rd at the Boston Opera House, bostonballet.org. And one last night of Beatles Mania. It all begins with How the Beatles Rocked the Kremlin. That's followed by great performances, Paul McCartney's Live Kisses, Thursday starting at 9 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is Callie Crossley. Scotty beamed her up a day early because Mayor Walsh will be with us for the hour tomorrow. She's the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley on Sunday night. She also hosts and moderates Basic Black. Hey there, Callie. Oh,
hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
Hey, Callie. Good to see you as always. So it is the 2-year anniversary of Trayvon Martin's death. And there have been a lot of pieces written talking about this sort of new normal in the age of stand your ground legislation. What do people mean by that? What are they talking about?
Well, the stand your ground legislation was really on trial, as you know, during that trial. And by the way, the actual anniversary was yesterday. And now, since then, there have continued to be, in Trayvon Martin's name and for other reasons, people protesting Stand Your Ground, saying, let's take another look at this. And it may seem like it's okay to just, you know, but everybody's definition is different about what standing your ground is all about. So, you know, I keep going back to the case of the woman in Florida. So,
great case. And by the way, people about this.
Yes, this is Marissa Alexander. She had an abusive husband. I think he's still alive. And he came in to attack her, and she fired warning shots. She did not hit him. Warning shots, like, get away from me. And they took her to jail. And if it were not for lots of people protesting that, still, she's gotten a chance now for a new trial, because they said, if this is not stand your ground, what is?
Didn't she get 20 years?
Yeah, something
she
ridiculous.
Got 20 years.
She didn't even hit him.
I know.
You know.
I find that case just mind-boggling.
And it's documented, by the way, for people who are saying, well, maybe nobody knows if whether or not he really abused her. No, she had documented, you know, abuse. It was clear that he was doing it. He had threatened to do all that. I mean, this just makes no sense to me.
You know, it's 2 years, as you say, from yesterday. Here's a quiz, in a day in advance of the Friday news quiz. Quiz question for you, Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
What was supposed to happen immediately after the shooting of Trayvon Martin that we're still waiting
for? Oh, I know.
You know the answer to the question?
Yes,
well, don't do it. What is it?
I think I do.
What was supposed to happen? Wow.
The big conversation on race.
Oh, right. Exactly.
Yes. We're going to have after every... Yeah. We've been having
it's
that since O.J. Simpson.
Yes. It's really like a Saturday Night Live skit, whether it's... Skip Gates at his house with Sergeant Crowley in my hometown and yours of Cambridge, or whether it's Trayvon Martin or, as you say, O.J. Simpson on the West Coast. It's like we should stop saying it. I mean, it's never going to happen.
That's why I watch Basic Black at 7:30 every Friday night. So
we do have it there.
You do have it there. Yeah. That's
but you know what's interesting about it?
Yeah.
The places and situations in which we can discuss race, in my opinion, are the easy ones. Everybody's talking about, is the head of the NFL going to mandate that you can't use the N-word on the field? And I don't mean this disrespectfully. who cares? Mm-hmm. I mean, I would argue that's not exactly the biggest issue confronting race relations in America. Everybody's okay with having that discussion, but to step back and have a deeper one is just, it is unbelievable,
you know,
about our inability.
Let me follow that up and say that Sherrilyn Ifill put it a way that you would appreciate, given what you've just said. She's a scholar and affiliated with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and she said, what we're talking about is pop racism. So anytime...
Perfect. That's a great
isn't
line.
Isn't that it?
That's
doesn't
a great
that say
line.
It?
Okay, let me be dense. I don't get it.
Well, anytime some pop culture thing happens...
It's like an easy, non-scary kind of way to have the... And then you can go home and say, I had the conversation.
Right, exactly.
Then we're done. Move
that's
on.
That's her point.
Yeah.
And we never get beyond that. But, you know, the stand your ground stuff is really interesting. This the white on black cases are usually the ones that are justified. The white on white ones, not so much. So I'm also watching, because you guys maybe heard this case, of the popcorn guy, the veteran. That's in Florida, too.
Yes.
And by the way, it's even worse, because have you seen the video? I mean, where he literally, this is the situation where the guy is, well, go ahead, tell us. I don't mean to.
You can tell it, too. I think he's 71-year-old veteran in the movies.
Former cop,
annoyed that a guy sitting with his wife is texting, tells him to stop texting. The guy says, you know, leave me alone. He continues to text. Turns out later he was texting the babysitter to make sure the kid was okay. And then the guy says something to him. He turns around and throws some popcorn at him. And then he pulls out a gun and shoots him dead. I mean, young man, you know, with these are all white people here.
Well,
you know?
I mean, you know, okay, so, what's your prediction for in the
I don't
stand
know.
Your
That's
ground
why
when the black guy shoots the white guy, Callie Crossley?
Well, I don't know. So far has not gotten to...
Somehow, I think it might be a different perspective.
I'm very interested in this case as well. Anyway, it just reminds us that, gosh, 2 years can pass fast. Some of these big issues we've never discussed, and some of the Stand Your Ground cases are still being protested in many states, not just in Florida, except the examples I just gave you were all in Florida.
Okay, so while we're waiting for the national conversation on race, let's have a local conversation on something. We're actually going to broach with our callers in 30 minutes or so. Is today the deadline for corporations or colleges or whatever to submit their bids to be able to name a T station?
Yes.
Tell people what led up to this.
Well, as you know, there is a shortfall, as we would say in economic terms, of funding for the T. So they're hoping to get business, the corporations, everybody that you just named, to buy in 5-year contract for, I think, $1 million. And that's a pretty good deal, by the way, to put your name on a train or on a stop. Now, if you want the whole train, you have to pay $2 million. But you can't be porn. No politics.
Porn.
No tobacco. There's a few
no
limitations.
Alcohol, because they don't allow alcohol ads
exactly.
on the TV.
But there's a wide, you know, expanse after that, you know, folks could come up. And I'm kind of curious to see who's going to step up with this.
There were some great suggestions. Should you read that little piece in the
Well, just do one, because we don't want to give them away. But Colin Young, who wrote, read the last one, Marjorie.
Okay.
What a suggestion.
This is the Preparation MGH Station.
Now,
that's actually a pretty
on the red line.
You know, Marjorie and I are going to have a debate about this later, and
that's
we're going to ask.
Interesting.
Where are you? I have to say, and I'm also a fiscal realist, but I'm a purist when it comes to these things. I understand they need the money, and where are you on this?
I kind of wish that you could use the names of, you know, people who meant something in the community or whatever. And I also wish that some of these corporations that have the money to do it might want to incorporate that. So maybe you honor somebody and you can use your name. That would make me at least feel better. I know they got to get something out of their money. They're not just giving it up for free. But that to me is just, you know, that's the old civic way. You know, you paid for something and you held up something that was important in the community, that was notable, that people should know about.
You know, but the one plus I have to say, and again, I've been a critic of this. I'll let the listeners in a half hour help shape where I end up on this. The plus that is argued by both the T and others is that if, for example, if Emerson, there's no indication they're going to do it, but if Emerson decided to do Boylston, because obviously they're right there, their goal is to have Boylston, which is Marjorie's least favorite stop because of
the squeaking,
which she asked the Secretary of Transportation about every time he's here, Rich Davey, they're going to want it to be as nice as possible if their name is attached to it.
Well, that's a good point.
So the downside is you have a corporate name on something you sort of feel shouldn't, but the upside is they're going to want to make it as nice as possible because it reflects on them. So that is a pretty powerful
argument. They cannot fix the squeak at Burlington
That's
Station.
What we're told, right?
Well, you know, it just reminds me, though, one of my favorite shows is Project Runway. And because they're so corporate.
I love Project Runway.
I do too.
We interviewed, what's the guy's name?
Tim Gunn.
We interviewed Tim Gunn
great.
About 2 years, one of the sweetest, most wonderful men
so
I've ever
talented.
Met.
But poor Tim Gunn, over the years, has been forced to say, the L'Oreal wall chest of so-and-so, the, you know, everything has a big, long corporate name because
that's
he's got to do it because they, you know, they're funding the show. I get it, but, you know.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm kind of excited about it. I think we could come up with some great names for some of these
stations. I just want people to step up because it really does, you know, we know, and particularly this winter, some of the delays, some of the, because of the repairs that need to happen. And look, we love our tea. I mean, it does, a lot of people are getting around, including me, when it snows. So I'm all about somebody step up and I'll be happy to call your name, I guess.
this is a very exciting story, particularly for you with a kid at Emerson. This whole new deal where Emerson is going to have a campus in Los Angeles to put these young people that want to go into the film industry.
It was smart or what?
Closer to ground zero. Tell people about it.
Well, you know, Emerson has been talking and doing this for years because they have a really strong alum out in Hollywood. People mostly know the actors, but, you know, they've trained a lot of people in production and writers, everybody you can name across the board in sort of media arts, if you will. A lot of folks have come from Emerson. So they've been talking about putting a permanent location there so that students who go out there to study, and they have been, and prior to this have been staying in leased apartments, would have a chance to really live there. And, you know, they'd have a building that was built for their needs and a state of the art. Well, they started this in 2008, which is, you know, as you know, the height of the recession. And you can imagine how, I can imagine for them how much pushback they probably were getting, like, come on, well, let's just drop that and move on to something else. Don't we have some other priorities? But I'm glad they hung in there. And they start building in 2012. The building is gorgeous. Look, if you see the picture.
It is really amazing.
They have housing now for some of the students who are going to be there. And it's all of the fields that we've just named and more. And they're having a big gala next week with some of their known alum, like Henry Winkler and Maria Menounos and
Dennis Leary
and
Jennifer Coolidge.
What's his former
Tonight Show? Is he not?
Yes, Jay Leno.
I don't know if he's going to be there. Yeah. Larry David's going to be there. His daughter, I believe it's daughter, is now an undergraduate.
I didn't know your
daughter
was there.
Yeah, she's a freshman. Yeah. She's loving the place. Yeah.
You know, they have a thing at Fordham, which is in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. They have, in addition to the Bronx campus, they have the Lincoln Center campus. Mm. So people that are into the arts and dance and theater. Taylor Schilling, who is the star of Orange is the New Black, went to the Rose Hill campus. A good friend of mine's kid, who was a dancer, made the Alvin Ailey Dancers, and there she was in the New York Times, Rosendale kid, and went to the campus at Lincoln Center. So it's a wonderful thing because these kids are right in the heart of New York City of where the theater district is there.
It's so smart.
And in Los Angeles of where the film industry is. It's a great, when you're paying all this money, man, it's a great
opportunity. Well, also, it's because of something you and I have discussed a million times, Marjorie, and I assume you would agree, Kelly. The more hands-on experience you can have in any kind of education, whether you're going to be a lawyer, a doctor, an actor, a producer, the more, one, you actually are better prepared for the real world and work, and two, you find out, maybe I don't even like this
thing. Well, that was going to be my point. It's so important that you know you don't want to do something before you get way down the road thinking in your mind you've imagined what you think it's all about. I just want to make the other point, and that is about long-term investment. Because at the time that, you know, people are asking for these monies to make long-term investment, that beautiful building doesn't seem real. You know, what the possibilities are doesn't seem real. And people are saying, really? Hollywood? You know, I can imagine. And, you know, you just have to stay the course to make something that I think is going to turn out to be fantastic over the years. This was truly an investment with a return already. And they have only been open a month.
You know, speaking of Under the Radar, which just happens, well, actually, it isn't the name of the show. It's Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley. Speaking of Under the Radar, I know one of your stories, I peeked, relates to Arizona. And it's not what we've all been talking about 24 hours a day, which obviously is what was vetoed last night by John Brewer, SB 1052 or whatever it was, you know, the religious freedom / anti-gay measure that she vetoed. What are you talking about that's going on in Arizona?
You know, you just can't make this stuff up. Just can't. We talk about a lot of media stuff because, of course, it's so important about, you know, the messages that are out there about certainly about certain groups. So an ad agency, 72 and Sunny, some people who are into advertising may know this ad agency was named the Agency of the Year, has come up with a fake gubernatorial campaign featuring Juanito, the illegal immigrant, running for governor.
I'm laughing. I don't know if you're supposed to laugh, but
it's ridiculous. And he has his hand in front of his face because, of course, he's, you know, undocumented.
Excuse me.
Okay,
excuse
and so,
me.
You know, this comes out. And by the way, this ad agency's normal big clients are Samsung and Target and ESPN and Google and Starbucks. So these are not people that shouldn't know, have some sensibility about how to do this. They say it's a satire to make people realize the importance of immigration reform and that people are not illegal. My contributor, who runs a website called Latino Rebels, wrote and said, I'm unclear about why using a pejorative term somehow makes this work. Then they wrote back and said, well, we're not just talking about people who are illegal in this country. We're looking at also the immigration problems in Europe. So, of course, he said, I don't understand how using a man who's clearly Mexican with his hand in front of his face as your picture of a campaign somehow speaks to immigration in Europe. Help me with that. Apparently, as of yesterday, they at least changed the Twitter account to say undocumented. But this is just like crazy.
Let me tell you
and
something.
It's very detailed.
I think he could get a lot of votes.
I was going to say, especially, did either of you happen to see Anderson Cooper's interview with state senator and gubernatorial candidate Al Melvin, maybe the dimmest-witted human being on the planet?
Bad.
One of the supporters, which you're entitled to support, but one of the supporters of the alleged religious freedom and we're not discriminating against gay things. And Anderson Cooper asked him about 18 different ways, can you give me one example, of a person whose religious freedom was violated because they had to do something that they didn't want to do. In other words, is this not a solution in search of a problem? Mm-hmm. And the guy couldn't come up with even one. It was, and the guy is running apparently as a serious candidate to be governor of Arizona.
A question: Jan Brewer is not running for re-election, as you know. She's the governor
of
Arizona. Out there,
term limited,
and she vetoed the bill, so it's not going to pass in Arizona, even though it came through the legislature. Do you think she would have vetoed the bill were she running again?
Oh, no. I am absolutely clear that she would never have vetoed that bill unless those business people.
Right.
Let's speak. NFL and Google got her in the room and said, are you kidding me? Oh, I don't think so.
But we should also credit Jeff Flake and John McCain, two Republican United States senators.
I think it's the money, though.
Well, maybe it is.
I think if she were running again, the jury's out, which is yet another argument for term.
I think she messed around that long because she was trying to figure out, is there a way for me to do this without messing up, you know, all the money that would come into Arizona? And remember, I mean, I don't think she's a stupid woman. She's got to have a plan for her life after she leaves office. I'm sure one of those corporations might have something for her, but not if she didn't make it possible for them to earn what they thought they should be earning in
Arizona. I actually heard she's applied for a casino job in Revere, but there's no confirmation. What else are you doing Sunday night on?
I don't know yet. This is early for me to talk about.
Oh, that's right. It's Thursday.
That's right.
Sorry.
So I can't tell you. It's really under the radar.
Good to see you, Kelly Crossley.
Oh, Kelly Crossley, of course, does usually join us on Friday, but she's not tomorrow because we're going to be joined by Mayor Marty Walsh. But you can keep up with her Friday nights at 7:30 on Channel 2, where she hosts and moderates Basic Black, where they are having that racial discussion we always talk about having. And Sunday nights at 6 o'clock right here on 89.7 for Under the Radar. Callie, thanks as always for coming in.
Thanks, Callie.
Thank you.
Next, Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam joins us to talk about a habit he does not want to kick, and it involves white powder. That's right. Confessions of a Weather Junkie is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Celebrate the rhythms of Ireland at a St. Patrick's Day Celtic Sojourn with Brian O'Donovan. Tickets are on sale now. For more information, visit wgbh.org/Celtic.
A look at the science behind obesity and the possibility that we've gotten the causes very wrong. I'm Kara Miller. That's this week on Innovation Hub, tonight at 9 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Lesley University, where creativity empowers educators, artists, and counselors to turn their passions into their futures. Lesley University, what will you make happen? More information available at leslieuniversity.edu. And the Joan and James Vernon Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, striving to provide patients with expert cancer care, innovative services, and treatment options. Information at nwh.org/cancer.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam. Marjorie, do you remember the conversation we had about Alex this morning?
Yes, I do.
Well, we were saying we always marvel at how perfect it is that his last name is Beam because his writing, Marjorie said, like Jim Beam, gets better with age and is best straight up. Alex, would you not agree? Would you? I mean, no, really.
Let's get out of here.
Well, nice to see you, Alex. How are you?
Thank you. I think I make less sense as the years go by, but.
Well, you have a column. You have a column today in the Boston Globe, which I think we can all relate to because the headline is "Confessions of a Weather Geek," which apparently you have become, Alex Beam. How did this happen?
Actually, it was like one of my neighbors. I was starting to mock me because I was like, you know, referring to conventional weather reports. And he had these like shadowy sources that he sort of wasn't willing to share with me. But he seemed to know about movements of air that like the rest of us sort of didn't know about, you know, at between 26,000 and 30,000 feet. I mean, it was like it was really crazy. This guy's a genuinely interesting person. But so I finally sort of broke down and I said, you know, you've got to let me in on the secret. And he took me to these weather underground blogs, which have been around for quite a while.
What does that mean, weather underground blogs? What does that mean?
Well, weather underground, interesting fact, according to its co-founder, Jeff Masters, that's the name of a website. Mm-hmm. It's fairly well known as Wonderground, W Underground. Mm-hmm. He said it started in 1995. He says it's the oldest internet website solely devoted to weather, much older than weather.com. He claims blah blah blah. Any case, it's for like the chart dudes, you know. It's all charts, but they did turn me on to. I actually didn't believe that it turned me on to the 16-day forecast. Which I was only able to find graphically, but the National Weather Service does produce a 16.
How accurate are the out days?
Oh well, don't get me started.
Well, I am getting you started. How accurate are the out days?
Oh, it's time to start.
How accurate are they? Like 14, 15, 16? How accurate?
My source on this guy Sasunas, who's quoted in the piece, probabilistically he feels they're quite accurate, mm-hmm. but not.
Did you say probabilistically?
Yes, because he likes to talk in a probability envelope of between 10 and 90%. That's where he's comfortable. And I said to him, that's useless, you know, to tell me there's between a 10 and 90% chance that we're going to have a blizzard. That's not useful to me. It's not useful to Governor Patrick.
No,
it's not useful to the superintendent of schools. But all these guys, they're totally into math. And he says, no, that's a superb forecast, if I can tell you, say, 15 days out within a 10% or 90% reliability that it's going to be, say, 45 degrees. Anyway, we're a little bit over my pay grade here. I'd be the first to admit.
But, you know, you have told me many times, Jim Browdy, that when you look at different what people tune into in the news, what do they tune into in the news?
Highest ratings that my station NECN gets by far is when Matt Noyes and his colleagues at NECN are standing by the green wall for hour after hour after hour. Giving weather, and by the way, the weather team at NECN, I'm not just saying because I work there, is superb. Matt is a leader, is a genius, whatever. But it is stunning. And that's what really what.
I did not know that, and that genuinely interests me. That must explain. Have you ever noticed how I'm a channel surfer. You know how they go horizontal with the weather in this market, you mm-hmm. know? In other words, NECN 4, 5, and whatever they're called, 7, they all have weather on at the same time.
Yes, they do. That's right. So you get very frustrated if you're trying to
compare
forecasts.
Yeah, but during a bad storm, we do it nonstop, yep. Which is – but that's what I want to know about your obsession here or whatever you want to call it.
I love it, too. I love the weather, too.
Well, wait, but there are different things. I am semi-obsessed.
We haven't even talked about weather babes.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute.
I hope so.
There are a lot of them.
I am interested because I actually care about the forecast. But knowing you a little bit that I do, Alex, my sense is you're more interested because you want to be part of that – subculture of, and I'm serious. Yeah, is that not what it is?
You are dead serious.
I knew it.
I am interested. In fact, I am interested only in subcultures. That's exactly right. I mean, and the internet, of course, has been a real gift to people interested in sub because everything goes really, really deep. And the No.
It does.
No, I know. 100% is what you said. And because actually, I have a fair amount of faith. I'm not a guy who bitches and moans about the weather, but I was fascinated how deep this goes because it's tailor-made for the internet because it's all about data and graphics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there's an infinite, even though, to be fair to myself, I do parse that there's a terrific difference between the kind of data and graphics that are, say, available in Europe as opposed to here. But having said that...
Are we better?
No, we're worse.
Really?
Astonishing.
Why is that?
Interesting question. The guy told me, quote, better science. He says it's not more computers. He says there's better science in Europe.
Really?
And then I asked, because it's, of course, interesting, I said, what about, you know, the legendary private sector, American agriculture, American aviation? These are vast industries that have a huge interest in the weather. I don't know. They just says Europe does it better. Now we're going to use a little jargon. They initialize their models better, which initializing is the data that you actually put into the model. I don't know. I mean, I asked, is it because there's like seven different countries investing? Nope. He says it's just better science. It's done better.
Does he mean better science in school leading to better meteorologists?
No. Just better meteorologists.
Oh, okay.
You know,
okay.
A couple of weeks ago, I said to Marjorie, I said, do you have any idea what Alex Beam's personal weather axioms are? And she said, no, I didn't even know he had any. And just what a coincidence. I'm reading this morning. He says, over the years, this is column in the Boston Globe, I have formulated, in which he did not have the courage to talk about weather babes, even though he does it with us. I have formulated two PWAs, or personal weather axioms. What are they, Alex Beam?
Right. I take these very, very seriously. One's quite serious because I've always noticed it. Whenever they're promising a warming, a cooling, a rain, or a snow, it's going to come about 12 to 14 to 18 hours later than when they said it was going to come. This is serious.
I know
this. And it's going to linger. And it's going to linger a day and a half or 2 days longer than they said previously. There must be some reason for that. I don't know. But it's strange. But that's worth noting, especially like the weather, the warming last weekend.
Yeah, I know.
They said it was going to be warm on Saturday, but it bled over into Sunday.
And it was it wasn't long enough, though. Over into Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Are we more into that? I mean, maybe it is because of the internet, but it seems to me, as you're talking, as I read your piece this morning, the obsession with weather, whether it's the subculture that attracts you or just the forecast that attracts people like Marjorie and I think me, the interest in weather is higher than it's ever been. I mean, amongst real people, not these nerds that you're hanging out with, right?
Fretting about the weather too, because I think everybody's looking at what does this mean? What does this mean? It's been freezing all this winter. What does this mean? The extremes of climate change, or not the extremes?
Do you see
climate
these
change?
Videos
I'm
and visuals?
I'm getting very paranoid about the weather.
Speaking of that, did either of you see the visuals last night on CNN and other places of these ice dams on rivers in the Midwest and places like Illinois and others?
Ice dams in my house.
Where they look, the rivers have frozen, so they look like they're small Rockies.
Yeah, it's scary.
It is really scary. And when they begin to melt and the river unfreezes, they wipe away virtually everything in their path. It's really so. Do you think that's it? The extreme weather?
Both of you talk, I definitely don't want to make a transition, but I'm just, it's, yeah, there's all this theorizing, a lot of it kind of with no particular basis in science. It's a lot like diet and food in a way, because people think, oh, the hurricanes, it must be global warming, da 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 da. The weather's weird, it must be this, it must be that. So it's become a kind of sump into which an enormous amount of kind of mythology, ill thought out theses. And then there's always these people who are definitely pumping climate change very hard.
A denier, are you?
I'm not a denier. I guess because you ask, I really feel that, as I recently wrote on Facebook, that only the dialectic leads to truth, meaning that only opposing arguments can yield truth. So I'm very surprised when our friend, you know, Juliet Kayyem says that she won't debate climate change
anymore.
Los
Angeles Times will not print letters to the editor from people who say climate change is not real.
Good example. And there's a third example out there. Major, serious institutions, major newspapers are saying, we're just not going to run any more stories on this. I encountered this actually at Stanford like 14 or 15 years ago. This Stephen Schneider, who's now dead, he stood in front of a group of journalists and said, you got to stop reporting the other side about climate change because they're liars. And I personally was shocked. I mean, I still am. I don't, All I'm saying is that doesn't seem like the way to get to the truth, to tell a group of people to shut up.
But are you saying the truth is not established? Is that where it is, as far as you're concerned?
I have to say, any reasonable person on the planet would have to say that the truth is, to use probability, is like definitely 80 plus established. Definite climate change, definite human role.
Something is changing because the people down in Scituate, their homes are falling into the water. So there's a bet on that.
I have a bet on that. There's a very famous bet. The guy's dead. And I can't remember the terms.
A lot of people you seem to associate with are now dead. That's
No, I bet somebody that the Marblehead Yacht Club would not have to move any of its piers in the next quarter century.
There are several.
Due
to
climate.
Corinthian Yacht Club, the Eastern Yacht Club.
You know, Marjorie wrote a piece about Marblehead. What magazine was that for?
Boston Magazine,
where she literally had to go on a witness protection program.
Why are you so hesitant about it?
Because I had this little teeny tiny Jewish yacht club with only three boats.
Is that what you wrote about?
No, I'm exaggerating. But there seemed to be these very elegant, beautiful yacht clubs that were the non-Jewish yacht
clubs. What were you saying? It was anti-Semitic? Was that the part
I didn't
of your...
say that,
you
saying
that the Jews have smaller yachts?
There just seemed to be this... antagonism about the yacht club.
That sounds like a terrific piece. You should be shouting it from the rooftop.
Yeah.
So, Alex, when all of us got an email from you in the last 24 hours, I have to say I was deeply offended by the content of it. I didn't even know you were a climate denier until a few minutes ago.
Exactly.
But in addition to that, you sent us a reference to a story. I almost can't say the words. It was on the Daily Beast. It said, Whole Foods, America's Temple of pseudoscience. And that cut right to the heart
for me. You know why? Because every day he's quoting some new food study. He's at Whole Foods every day at the hot
Several
bar.
Times
Sometimes
I have.
I've met Jim at Whole Foods.
Yes. Oh, we have. In Newton.
Yes.
That's right on Washington Street.
Yesterday, he's over there eating like this broccoli and these Brussels sprouts. Yesterday he hands me this dried apple and says, Marjorie, this dried apple will lower your cholesterol.
Your bad cholesterol.
And increase
That's
your good cholesterol. That's
a huge amount of sugar
And
in
you'll
too.
Live forever.
You know where I learned that, by the way?
All this
Whole Foods, exactly.
Of course.
And the question in this piece is a terrific question. Why is it that all the good liberals ridicule the pseudoscience at the Creation Museum down in Kentucky, but they absorb the pseudoscience at Whole Foods by it? Swallow it, hook, line, and sinker. So what's the answer, Alex?
I don't know, but we should give a shout-out. Is the author's name Michael Shulman? Is that it?
I couldn't find who wrote it.
It's on the Daily Beast.
I'll find out what you're
talking. It's their number one article trafficked on the right-hand well. It's utterly hilarious.
Michael Shulman, yes.
Yeah, because as the straw man, he uses the Creation Museum, which, of course, all right. what could be more reviled?
You know, exactly.
What could be more reviled?
In Kentucky.
Even worse, right? The entire state of
Kentucky.
Exactly. Since you're not syndicated, we can say that, you know?
So explain his point.
Well, his point is just terrific. He simply says... This stuff that quote unquote we believe, like I didn't demand that you mock me. I've been on a gluten-free diet for 8 days.
Is that really true?
Yeah.
How's it going?
Yeah, it's okay.
You look good.
It's ridiculous.
You look really good.
Yeah. I'm feeling great, by the way. Yeah. I mean, that's a great example of something that is complete hogwash. Unless you have celiac disease, we open the little parenthesis, fine.
You're channeling Emily Rooney with
Listen
those words.
Listen to this line. Do you have the story in front of you?
I know it's in
Listen
the story.
Listen to this line. At Whole Foods, he says, you can buy chocolate with a meld of rich goji berries, whatever those are, and ashwagandha root to strengthen your immune system. And then you can move on to buy the chloroxygen chlorophyll concentrate.
I have a case of that.
To build better blood. And he's right. I mean, I'm at Whole Foods all the time, too. I love it because you feel very healthy.
Because you got to get that yogurt for $2 a whack.
Yeah. Oh, and he totally knocks probiotics. Said he went there with some biologist friend who said it was all a bunch of hogwash.
That's a great quote.
She said a word we can't use here on the radio about the healing claims of probiotics. He just rips it all to shreds.
I know. I don't want to reorient this, but there's a certain, I mean, yeah, we enlightened people look down on creationism, and we certainly look down on intelligent design because we're all so smart.
That's right.
And here's a whole sector of science where, indeed, it's just immediately evident that we're completely ignorant. So that's alas, when it comes to climate, also I feel like maybe our belief system is analogous to our belief system here. I'm just saying it never hurts to ask questions.
So let me be clear, just because I'm making notes. You're 80% on climate change. Are you 80% on evolution too, or are you like at 85%?
Where
are you?
That's
a smart
9 days, not
although,
6 or 7.
I recently read a fascinating debunking article about the paleo diet, which a friend of mine is deeply into.
What is it?
Oh, everyone knows about the paleo diet.
The paleo diet, that's where you eat like a caveman.
Yeah, you eat like
raw meat.
Oh, okay. It's more hogwash science.
Yeah.
It's as if our bodies never evolved. And so the thesis is you have to eat the way your body was originally, quote unquote, designed, and you cut out agriculture, basically.
Correct.
Yeah, and you eat like sawtooth tigers or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And you hunt and berries and you get nuts.
I can't believe you don't know about the paleo diet, Jim. You know all about probiotics.
Well, it turns out that's hogwash. I read a totally convincing argument taking that down because it turns out like there's so many different cave people, cavemen, cave women, all evolving at different times. Our seven great hominid ancestors all evolved.
Yeah.
So there's no starting point for when we were paleo, et cetera, et cetera.
So wait a second. Getting back to Michael Shulman for one second about Whole Foods.
Great
he
piece.
Asked the question. I'm not sure you answered it. So why do many of us perceive Whole Foods in the infamous Creation Museum, infamous, my word, so differently? What's it? Why do we? Because you were right, and he is right. We all would mock the Creation Museum, particularly one in Kentucky, but I would say anywhere. And we all swear.
He answers
I know. I'm asking Alex. What is the deal?
Is this a test?
A test. Well, you suggested that.
I know. I don't read anything.
Okay, Marjorie. What is
okay,
his
what's
answer?
The answer?
He says we're all a bunch of hypocrites.
Okay. Well, that's a good answer.
That for some reason, there's a special stream of American rage directed at ideological attacks on science that seems to evaporate when the offender is a for-profit corporation.
Although, one thing he doesn't go into there, which really surprised me, I'm sure you know, I mean, a column I've been dying to write is that, the Whole Foods is owned by a Bush...
Big-time anti-Obamacare.
Yeah, big anti-Obamacare, and I'm sure he has... I mean, must be totally cynical. I'm sure he has no truck with any of this pseudoscience whatsoever. I mean, he's all about money. And I was dying. Do you remember when they had his book stacked up there next to
the sure.
I was dying to trash that. I sort of never got around
but
to
it. But
he
supposedly treats his employees incredibly well.
I think he does.
You want to tell Alex what you're eating today, Jim?
Yeah, I have a little broccoli, carrot, and some other thing. Don't worry about what it is.
You know where I had lunch, by the way?
Where was it?
McDonald's.
You did. Good
yep.
for
does
you.
Does it have any goji berries on there, Jim?
Marjorie, it's not your
How
business.
How about ashwagandha roots?
It does have. I sprinkled some ashwagandha.
That's great. When the floods come, man, you'll float right away.
Alex, can we briefly ask you about a couple of current events? Because Marjorie and I were questioning. We didn't know where you were on these things. I'm serious.
All
big
right,
week
yeah.
on the casino front. Yesterday, Revere votes 60-some percent in favor, so they're in the mix. It's Everett versus Revere for the Eastern Mass Casino. Is today Thursday? Tomorrow, we find out where the slots parlor goes. Yeah, Marjorie said this morning to me, she says, Alex is so not the kind of guy you'd find in a slots parlor at 3 a.m. And I looked at her and I said, Alex is exactly the kind of person you'd find at a slots parlor, unshaven and unshowered
Ooh, wow,
at 3 a.m. Who's right?
Well, I guess slots is okay. My mom used to give my kids money for slots.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's really true.
That's great.
She was into the slots. I would, if I could win, I'd gamble. I'm not a big winner.
How do you feel about them coming? Have you written about this?
I have. This is your thing. I listen to your show.
So what are you saying? So where are you on this whole casino?
I'm a Harshberger guy.
Bad idea. Harshberger, former attorney general, is leading the opposition, championing the repeal.
But I'm only on his side, because he's the son of
Lutheran
a reverend
minister.
He's
yeah.
son of a minister.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I've been reading the Globe's coverage. I listen to what you guys have on your show. You know who's really insane? I shouldn't be saying that. But you know who's really adamant is
adamant. Yes.
Yeah, adamant.
Who?
Bob Massey.
Lieutenant governor with Mark Roosevelt.
Yes.
With Mark Roosevelt.
Yeah,
he's an unbelievably intelligent guy.
Against them.
Oh yeah, militantly.
Well,
against.
Isn't he a minister as well?
Yes. Oh, he's an ordained minister, and he went to the Harvard Business
School.
Didn't
he marry John Kerry? And I believe he married John Kerry and Therese Hines.
I think
people should Google his name and casinos. I mean, he has a very powerful. a principled stand. I mean, it's a stand that I find a little extreme, but I mean, he's dead serious.
By the way, just one more thing about before you go, good friend of mine whose opinion I respect said that his autobiography, Bob Massey, is the single best autobiography they have ever read, for whatever it's worth.
Well, I wonder what book he's talking about. Be careful. Is he talking about a book that Bob's parents wrote about?
No, I thought Bob wrote about his own medical condition.
Didn't he have
hemophilia? Yeah, didn't he write his? Maybe I'm wrong.
I'm going to give a. First of all, God bless you, Bob Massey. Second of all, one of the most moving books I've ever read was written by his parents. It's called Journey. It's still in print, and it's about raising a hemophiliac.
Oh, maybe that's what they were speaking.
I think it
about.
Is, because I think Bob Massey's, I mean, I was on his website, I think, just yesterday, and he has a major book he's very proud of about the free elections in South Africa. Mm. He was a monitor for those.
Really?
Yeah.
I was over at Suffolk Downs with the Herald the other day. You know who I saw there that's there gambling every day?
Oh, no.
Phil Orlandella, that used to be the spokesperson for Massport. So there's this whole coterie of all these retired guys that hang out there every day.
The ponies.
They get in there at noon. They get the racing equipment. They're there till 4, and they go home and cook dinner. It's like where they hang out.
I want to go to the dog track. I'm a dog track kind of guy.
I've been down there.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
when they were having the fight about whether the dogs were being mistreated or not.
Oh, that I did write about. I was so on the wrong side. They got hate mail, of course.
Did you think they were mistreated at the dog tracks?
Not particularly. And I opposed the closing of the dog tracks. And because Oliver Newton, you see these bedraggled, totally miserable, you know, former greyhounds now being tortured by
liberals. Well, let's put this in context.
Alex
is the writer who said, kill all the coyotes. Was that not you?
Stand by that.
Okay, fine.
The world agrees with me, by the way. And kill the snowy owls. Give me a break. Wait till one of those jets goes down. Mark my words.
Okay.
Oh, you laugh. I don't think so.
Alex Beam.
What about current events? Are we done with current events?
No, we're going to Whole Foods.
We're done.
Exactly.
Good to see you, Alex.
Alex Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe. You can read his great column about being weather obsessed today in the Boston Globe. He is the author of many books, which, as usual, we have to say there. You can't mention any of the titles.
But soon we will.
For reasons I don't quite understand. Anyway, we're up next. We're going to be talking. We're going to continue what we left off talking about with Callie Crossley. Naming rights for MBTA stations. Today is the deadline for businesses to get their requests for proposals in. Would you like to take a train to Yankee Candle Yawkey Way or to Dunkin' Donuts Downtown Crossing? That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
I'm Marco Werman. We're there when the world trembles.
These clashes have been going on for 24 hours.
When the world changes.
This is a large protest movement.
When the world catches its breath.
Now some of the barricades are removed, but the mood is very somber because nobody is sure that this is really the victory.
Join us and hear the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you and Mass Eye and Ear. Sense life, experience life. When vision problems affect the way you experience life, experience the difference Mass Eye and Ear can make. Visit masseyeandear.org for more information. And Astrum Solar, providers of renewable solar power systems for homes. You can learn more at astrumsolar.com/NPR or call 1-844-ASTRUM-0. That's 1-844-ASTRUM-0.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie again. Today, as Marjorie just said, is the deadline for businesses and universities, anybody else, to submit their proposals to name one of, I think, 11 stations or something. Maybe it's 8 stations. We'll have the honor or, I guess, disgrace, some might say, depending on how you feel, to bear the name of a business, a university, something like that. It's the corporation creep. We've seen it with Boston Garden. We've seen it with Great Woods. Are you ready for it to conquer the MBTA? Our number is 877-301-8970. Let's talk about the plus side for a second, because as I said earlier to Callie, historically, I was totally against this. You were fine with it, if I recall. We've had this discussion with Rich Davey, former head of the T. Right, $18 million for a cash-strapped organization. That's number one. And number two, the argument I read today that I have to say almost moved me to the other side of the question is the common sense argument that if a major corporation or a university has its name on a T station, they're going to want the T station not to be a dump because it's essentially one of the faces of that institution, you know, whether it's whatever it is. And I have to say, I find that somewhat compelling. But we want to know how you feel, particularly you tea writers, but even if you're not, about assigning corporate names for $1 million, $2 million to a stop, to a whole line. I think for a couple of million dollars, you can actually put your name on the whole Green Line kind of thing. And if you have suggestions for particular stations with particular names, you can email them. Where can they email them, Marjorie?
They can email them. I know you think I don't know the email.
No, I don't. Maybe you do.
BPR@WGBH.org.
Very good.
So there.
I think that's correct.
You have little faith, Jim.
How do you – do you still think this is a great idea?
It doesn't bother me. I'm not particularly attached to Park Street Station, Kenmore Station. I think the T is really in financial trouble.
It is. That is for sure.
And they really need the money. And
that
the T is pretty old. The stations are pretty horrible looking. They have to charge people, you know, particularly the people that are depending on the ride and that sort of thing, astronomical amounts of money. Since the T Pension Board is hiding all the finances there, we can't even find out how much money they've wasted. It doesn't bother me at all.
Our number is 877-301-8970. About a year and a half ago, this guy, Colin Young, he was a part-timer at the Globe. I don't know if he's still there, wrote a piece about some suggested names. And these actually got me a little more excited. He said, for example, Legal Seafoods Aquarium Station. That is terrific. I'm sure Roger Berkowitz would do that in a minute. We'll see. My favorite was, if you get on the Red Line, one name could possibly be Preparation MGH Station, which is made the best.
Yeah.
How about the Heinz, H-E-I-N-Z, the Heinz
That's
Convention
right.
Center
Could
is a
in.
Terrific idea.
Or the Sam Adams Alewife Station.
Yeah, well, that they can't do because from what my understanding is, when they put out the request for proposals or whatever they're called, is they said certain things, I mean, obviously something that is obscene they won't do. And since they prohibit alcohol ads, I'm pretty sure they do prohibit alcohol ads on the T, you can't, an alcoholic beverage company, even though Sam Adams obviously is local, could not name it. It's just, you know, I have to say there's certain things that you sort of want as they were. And I agree with Kelly. In an ideal world, and I think Kelly's sort of agnostic on this too, from a few minutes ago when we spoke, it'd be really nice if we could name the stations after people of major contributions through the years.
Yeah, well, that's not going to bring them any money.
Well, why didn't they?
They already had the Ted Williams Tunnel.
Well, I was just going to say, why don't they name it the TD North Tunnel? They decided, but Ted Williams wasn't funding the thing, that it was important to honor. So in the most expensive public works project, I think, in the history of the United States,
that's right,
where obviously they needed the money, they decided there not to do that. So
the T is in terrible shape.
I understand it's in terrible shape.
I mean, they do have at least these new Green Line trains, where they look a little bit better, but it's just a mess. The stations are so dirty. They can't keep raising the prices. People can't afford it. They raise the prices too high. They need the money, and if they're going to call it the Sitco Triangle Kenmore Station or something, that'd be kind of fun, actually, the Sitco Triangle Kenmore Station. I don't really care. On the other hand, I'm getting emails from people who do care. George
says,
some years ago there was talk about selling the naming rights to Fenway Park. I swore that if that happened, I'd put up a website to solicit contributions to buy the states and name it money grubbing expletive deleted stadium. Oh, please, can we have anything that isn't just another form of advertising? He also says, oh, poor George is passionate about this. He says his college, Columbia University Engineering School, sold the naming rights to the school to the FU, F-U Foundation. This is not a joke, he says. My alma mater is now named FU. And I'm not pleased.
Is that really true?
That's what he says.
You know, but the flip side, I'm trying to buttress my own historic arguments, even though the cleaning up of the stations and putting them in much better maintenance actually is compelling to me. Since the new Boston Garden was the Fleet Center for a while, then it was the Shawmut Center, I think something else in between. Now it's the TD Bank North Garden. How many people call it the TD Bank North Garden, and how many people call it Boston Garden?
I still call it the Boston
Garden. Everybody calls it Boston
Garden. You can't keep up with the name changes.
Right. So, but maybe the argument that would get me over the hump on this thing is no one's going to use the new names anyway. Yes, there'll be some ads, but there are ads there anyway. They're going to call them whatever they called them historically.
Robert says Yale Appliance should buy the rights to Harvard Square.
That's actually very clever.
Very
that's
clever.
Very
I like
good.
That very much. Our number is 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Are you, like Jim, outraged?
No, I'm not outraged anymore. I'm like, no, I'm
in
the
frenzy,
middle. I'm
frothing
ambivalent,
at the mouth, steam coming out of your ears over the prospect of corporations buying the names to our beloved Park Street, Boylston Station. I don't have these warm feelings about the Park Street Station.
Do you remember years ago there was a – am I wrong about this? Please correct me if I am. Wasn't there a discussion about whether or not Boston Common was going to – the naming rights are going to be sold? Am I right about that? But let's – whether I'm right or wrong, how would you feel about Boston Common's naming rights being sold – forget Subway Station – being sold to the highest corporate bidder? Would you, would that trouble you?
Boston Common would trouble me.
Well, right, exactly. So, I mean, it's, the proverbial slippery
Boston
slope
Common
is upon us.
It means something to you. You know, it's on top of the garage. You walk across it to get to the public garden.
Kendall Square Station doesn't mean something to you?
No, it does not, Jim.
It actually doesn't mean anything to me either. 877-301-897. Let's take a handful of calls. Jeff, you're in Plymouth. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Which side are you on, Jeff?
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I realize it's an authority independent, but why stop there? We can have the Juicy Fruit City Hall, the Cocoa Puffs State House. I'll let you guys go. I realize you have other callers,
yeah,
but it's an absolutely lousy idea.
Well, those two have some lack of certain gravitas, I guess you'd say. Juicy Fruit City Hall.
Hey, you know, our colleague Amanda found what I was looking for. And I thought I was right, and I was. Do you remember when I guess, I don't know what it was called at the time. Whatever the name of the new garden was at the time, the Shawmut name went up, and it was Shawmut Center. Just as it was being completed, do you remember what happened?
Yes,
Fleet Bank. Merged with Fleet Bank.
Fleet Bank brought that.
And so even before it was, formally, exactly.
Was it the Fleet Center before it became the TD Bank North?
I don't know.
You're right. Who calls it the TD Bank North? Right. Nobody does.
But, you know, I have to say, in a private venture, which is what the new Boston Garden is, I mean, that's obviously, it's a fine. It's just... In the public world, I'm sure someone's going to call and say, what would you prefer, Jim? We raise the already high cost of the ride? And the answer
somebody already did.
I don't want you to. So, Jim, you know, put up or shut up. And I guess the
Jack
answer is
that.
I should probably shut up.
Why don't you? He told you to shut up because
he thinks,
well, yeah, you're going to have taxpayers going to have to pay more to keep the tea afloat. That was Jack's position. You know, it reminds me of the Olympics. When you looked at the Olympics, the skiers, every inch of their body.
Do you not hate that?
Well, but why do they do it? They need the corporate sponsorships to afford their training. So
how about those ridiculous golfers? Do you ever see them like head to toe? They are well, the NASCAR drivers are the worst.
Yeah.
But but again, that's a private deal. If they want to do it in a private set, it's just, again, you know, where do you draw the line? You and I both agree naming Boston Common would be abhorrent, but naming a subway station is okay with you and is, I guess,
well, again,
sort of okay with me, even though I prefer not to.
I have historical warm feelings about the public garden and Boston Common. I mean, do you get excited about, you know, Boylston Street
Station? Can I tell you something, the truth? I wasn't going to say this in the air. When they closed City Hall Station for 2 years the other day, I wept.
Wait a minute. It's not called City Hall Station.
Whatever it is.
It's called Government
Whatever
Center.
It is. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's how upset I was about it, Marjorie.
Okay.
I couldn't even say
City
its name.
City Hall Station. Let's go to Lisa in Cambridge. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
What do you think?
I am so against this, and partly it's just a visceral reaction. I really dislike things that belong to all of us being named for these corporations.
That's what I was trying to say, but didn't. But thank you for saying it.
Sure.
Go ahead.
But I ride the T all the time, so I do have the feeling about it, even though I suffer on it sometimes. I've ridden the T for decades and decades, and I do have not a warm feeling, but a loyalty and a feeling of history about it. And the places, the stops are named for real places, and they're places that mean something. And I'm constantly giving directions to people. You know, I live near Harvard Square, and I'm running into people, I'm giving people directions. And I think it would also be really confusing. It just makes it like everything else in the world. You're just being sent to the name of some corporation instead of something that is linked to an actual place.
That was eloquent. How about that, Marjorie?
No, that's
respond
beautiful.
To Lisa from Cambridge. That was beautiful. Thank you, Lisa.
Lisa from Cambridge, that's a beautiful sentiment. I guess I'm ready to be a sellout. I was just thinking that, you know, if colleges, which of course now cost $60,000 a year, if the college would pay you maybe like $10,000 to wear their hats and sweatshirts.
I have two in college. I do that in a second.
Wouldn't you lie right up? I mean, I just, whatever it takes.
I'd get
I don't
a
care.
Tattoo on my forehead exactly. if it saved me $10,000.
Yeah. If they knock $30,000 off the price, you do over your whole face. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's very expensive.
It is, but what she said, and she really, at least it was Elisa, said it really eloquently.
Even though
subway stations
She's
aren't
right.
something you feel terribly warm about, they do belong to all of
no,
us. That's
I'm,
her argument.
I'm
and
a sellout,
it's compelling.
Jim. I'm admitting it right here on the radio. Let's go to fine. Sam on the road. What do you think, Sam?
Yeah.
Hi, Sam.
Hello.
You're on. Yeah,
hey,
take
I
it away.
I'm taking my call. Sorry. I got to disagree with the last caller. I think that, we don't own the place. It's the corporations that own the place. And I think it makes perfect sense to name the T-stops over the people that own the place and TD Bank North. But I think you got to change the name of the streets, too.
Well, by the way, I don't think it's ridiculous to think that that's next. Why? I mean, you're serious, right, Sam?
Of course. I mean, I think your name should reflect the reality. We used to live in a democracy. Now we live in a corporatocracy. They should get the naming rights. Let's call real. I mean, it's silly to pretend otherwise.
You
right?
know, by the way, Sam,
That's
you raised an interesting point.
Point.
Marty Walsh is with us an hour tomorrow. Do you believe the nerve of this guy thinking we should continue calling this place Boston? I mean, is that
ridiculous?
I mean, you make such. I'm going to bring it up with him. I'm going to challenge
mean, come
him.
On.
Thank you, Sam. That's excellent. Sam, thanks for the point. He makes
what
a great
do we
point.
Call it? What is the richest corporation of Boston? Do you know?
I don't know what it is. But there are a million. There are so many of them. I assume Gillette could be the new name of Boston. That's a possibility. Gillette, Massachusetts.
They all run around with little razors sewed onto
really?
Our shirts. Let's go to Lorianne in Lunenburg. Hi, Lorianne.
Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you
totally
for making it.
I totally hate the idea.
Why?
To me, it's the capitalization of America, and everything is owned by something, some big corporation. And I never call the garden the TD Bank North Center or whatever it is. I don't even know what to call. I don't even know the real name. I just always call it the garden. It's the Boston Garden.
Yeah.
But Lorianne, just don't go away. Let me pose for you the question that I can't come up with a good answer. I used to hate it as much as you do. Now I'm sort of in the middle, which I can't stand people that dwell there. But I'm there at the moment. What do you say to the person that says, for the worker who has to ride the T, you either pick up the $18 million that the T says it can take, or you raise the fares $18 million, or some such thing? I mean, how do you respond to that?
You know, I have to be honest, I don't really have another answer.
Well, you're an honest woman.
I don't know what the answer is, but I don't think it's this. I have to say, I went to Emmanuel College, and I went to Wheelock College, too. I got a master's. And, to me, the Fenway stop is always going to be the Fenway stop. I would hate to see it named something else.
Hey, Lorianne, thank you for the call. I mean, there's an emotion there, and I tend to share that emotion, but the fiscal reality is tough to escape.
Scott says, that you could call Boston Common the Citizens Bank Boston Common, and no one would ever really call it the Citizens Bank Boston Common.
But how
Boston
would you
Common.
Feel about that
so
if the sign as you got there?
You take the money, you get all the money, but just ignore the edict to call it the Citizens Bank
Marjorie,
Boston Common.
I'm going to tell you a story that I told you about 10 years ago on
the
air.
Okay, it's okay. Tell me again, Jim.
I'm in Beijing.
You're in Beijing.
I go into the Forbidden City.
Ooh.
The Forbidden City has many, many, many different layers. You go further. And one of the reasons it's so wonderful and beautiful, this is a totally true story, is because the further you go, the more proud you are of yourself because fewer people walk the whole distance. This is a totally true story. Go through one beautiful structure, another, probably dozens of beautiful structures. I finally get to what is the last or close to the last. This is true. And there's a sign, I think it was bronze or something, sign on the wall of the final or next to final structure. And you know what it said? I can't believe I didn't think of this till just now. This portion of the Forbidden City brought to you by American Express. Now, I can't believe I'd forgotten that till just now. That's probably why I have this reaction to
okay.
I mean, how would you feel? You haven't been there, but how would you feel if the next thing is great monuments? Our national parks, by the way, are starving for cash. Do we sell naming rights to national parks? Why shouldn't we? If it's going to keep them open to the public, why shouldn't we? I mean, that's the problem with all this.
That is pretty depressing, seeing this brought to you by
this
American
portion,
Express.
This segment or portion of the Forbidden City brought to you by American Express.
I just won't go to Beijing. solve that problem.
Actually, you should. It's great. Let's take one more quick one. Dan, you're in Worcester. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Dan.
Jim.
Hi. Hey, Dan.
This naming rights thing with corporate, I have two comments to make. One is about the naming rights of things. I don't believe in that. I think that, you know, cities like Boston and other places have historic names for their places, and people are accustomed to them. And, you know, imagine giving directions to someone, you know, and saying, well, you start off at Charlie's Burger Station, and then you get off over there, and you go over to, you know,
no, it's true.
Handbag Station. I mean, it doesn't even make any sense. It's ridiculous. But one other thing that bothers me about my left-leaning friends is everybody's against corporations, and I just don't understand that whole mindset and concept. Corporations, you guys yourselves draw your paychecks from a corporation. Corporations are America. It's what we are. It's how we make our money. It's how we pay our bills. They're these big, ugly monsters, but not really.
Well, let me be clear, Dan. Dan, I should have been clear earlier. If they want to name any station WGBH station, we are totally fine.
Or,
hey, Dan, thanks as always.
If they want to name anything, the Browdy Bridge. I mean, you might have a different perspective.
What's a tribute to a great Bostonian?
Absolutely.
That's the difference.
We'd all be behind that. Okay, enough of that. We are moving on. When we come back, we mark Women's History Month with a look at the innovative women past and present all around America and the world. Karen Miller joins us for that conversation. It was depressing to think about how few innovative women I could even think of this morning. Karen's going to fill us in. Up next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Unnatural smells from extracting natural gas.
I'm having nosebleeds. I have headaches. There's a chemical smell in the air. My kids are sick. I think it's being caused by this industry.
A possibly devastating air pollution threat in gas-rich Texas, and the best the politicians can do is hold their noses. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Live Nation, presenting Willie Nelson and Family, together with Alison Krauss and Union Station, featuring Jerry Douglas, with special guest Casey Musgraves, June 17th, Blue Hills Bank Pavilion. Tickets available Friday at livenation.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. March is Women's History Month. We're going to get a jump start on it with a focus on innovative women, past and present. In a couple of minutes, we're going to ask you to join the conversation. Who would you like to see in the Innovative Women Hall of Fame? Our number is 877-301-8970. Here with us in Studio 3 is someone who's been focusing a lot on that. She is Kara Miller, host of the Innovation Hub. Hi, Kara.
Hi.
Well, Kara, I said before you came in, it was depressing when I was trying to think of women innovators. I couldn't think of that many.
I know. Well, I think when we think of, I mean, really, I think if you went out and stopped people on the street and said, who do you think are the really innovative people in this country, you'd get, you know, like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg. And, you know, I don't think you'd get a lot of women's names. Do you think, can you think of people that would roll off the tongue?
Well, we thought of one upstairs this morning, which is Julia Child.
Well, didn't think of it.
Chelsea thought of it. That's, you know, certainly innovating in cooking. And Chelsea also thought of Dr. Ruth, that
yes.
Child was talking about
yes.
sex. And she has a great little voice.
Most of the names we came up with, Karen, answer your question, were not really innovators. They were glass ceiling breakers. I mean, you know, Janet Yellen is head of the Federal Reserve Bank, first woman, but she's not. It's not because she's innovative.
Right.
It's because she's the first woman to have
right.
that kind of job.
It's very different being the first person as right. being somebody who came up with something. I think Julia Child is actually brilliant. And part of the reason Julia Child is brilliant is because here is somebody – you have to think about what she was doing at the time she was doing it. She was like, you know, let's put a show on the air. It's about food. nobody's going to be able to taste it or smell it. And it's black and white, so they're barely going to be able to see it. But I'm sure people are going to be into this. You know what I mean?
Right.
And you think at the time...
six-foot-tall woman with a weird voice,
right,
too, doing
this. Yeah, exactly. It's an awful sell. And it turned out to be a great idea.
Oh, yeah.
But that's what innovators do. I mean, that is the essence of the Mark Zuckerbergs, you know, that people say to him over and over, oh, we'll give you this much money and this much money and this much money. And he says, you know, no, I came up with this new idea. I don't know whether it's going to sink or swim, but I believe in it enough.
So if there was a Women Innovators Hall of Fame, as we're going to ask people in a minute to call in and make nominations, assuming they can, who would be the first inductees? Who would be any inductees? This is horrible.
I'll throw out a few names that are interesting that I think not that many people are going to know. Do you know Ada Lovelace?
No.
Okay.
I wasn't going to say no till Marjorie did. I wanted to
make sure I
was not the outlier here. No, I don't
either. And then you
would have
said, like, oh, yeah, I totally know who she is.
Okay. Who is it?
She is credited by many people as the first computer programmer. She was the only legitimate child of Lord Byron, the great poet.
Really?
She had a lot of children, but only one legitimate child. Yes, she only lived to the age of 36 years old, and she wrote the first algorithm.
What's her first name?
Ada Lovelace. Her name is
Lovelace.
Ada Lovelace.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's an interesting person for your next cocktail party.
Who else?
Rosalind Franklin is somebody who a lot of people think of. She helped Watson and Crick come up with DNA, and a lot of people feel like she totally got shafted in that deal. So that's one person. Then there's some really interesting contemporary people that you might think about. I think Martha Stewart is actually a very interesting person.
I think that's a great one.
Great one. Absolutely great. Well, now, I guess maybe she might be more a glass ceiling person than an innovator.
Who's that?
But Barbara Walters. But you know
what?
Maybe the View. I mean, you have to think, what did she come up with that
never
been anything like that
before?
She's
a hard news. I mean, while people love to ridicule her, she's actually a really smart, great, hard news person who actually brought lighter
and
pieces
she also
into
did,
interviewing and news.
Hard question, soft question interviews
with
great heads of state. You know, the whole Sadat thing that she did that was groundbreaking. You know who I think in the arts world, just because I like the domestic, her approach was the painter, Mary Cassatt, who did paintings of mothers and their children,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, was new. And I think she's wonderful. And I think that was innovative.
So when you originally, Karen, when you came in and I knew you were going to name people in the sort of technology world, my question was going to be, which isn't appropriate in light of how broad the sweep is, but I'll ask it anyway. I assume the reason for the scarcity was because we've lived through an era where in things like science and math, women weren't given the same opportunity and that sort of thing. But what's your take on why the absence of women from that list is so broad in so many fields? I mean,
we all
have so much trouble. What is that about? Male domination or something?
Yeah, I mean, even if you look at CEOs, and I know CEOs are not necessarily a measure of innovation, but yes, exactly. If you look at, you know, Steve Jobs certainly was, right? If you look at Fortune 500 companies right now, 4% are run by women. But then you think, I think myself, that's just the largest companies. I bet if you broaden it out, there's more women running companies. So you look at the 3,000 largest companies in the U.S., 3% are run by women. So the truth is, when it gets broader, it doesn't get much deeper in terms of having a lot of women. I it's hard to say. I mean, there's so many schools of thought, and you know, people may call in and have schools of thought on this, but there's so many schools of thought on like why women aren't, you know, at the top. Is it because they didn't want to be? You know, they had good ideas, but they passed that idea on to somebody else. I mean, you know, that there's discrimination, that's certainly a possibility. I mean, there's a lot of people who think, look, there are really good women up near the tops of companies, but they do not get picked to be at the top. They do not get picked to be the person saying, here's the next idea, here's the next big direction we're going in.
You know, the person you met was about DNA you mentioned a couple of minutes
Rosalind
ago.
Yeah, Rosalind Franklin.
I mean, there are many instances of women who were at least co-players, if not leaders.
Well, Madame Curie.
Who ended up not getting the credit for things.
You know, I'll tell you somebody else who's really interesting who I've thought a lot about, and actually we talk about a little bit on the show, Jane Austen. Going out of the world of technology.
That's a great one because she changed the novel.
She changed the novel. She came along at a time when people were writing about murders and
that's
like,
great.
You know, all these very exotic things, people going to other places. And she said, you know, I think we should write novels about ordinary things, things that are happening to middle class families, not upper class families, middle class families in the household. And by the way, Jane Austen during her life was not particularly popular. She had to pay to have her stuff published initially. Shelley. After that, she could only get it published by a military library, which is kind of insane when you think about Jane Austen. And she had tons of suitors, turned all of them down and said, you know what? Other people have their kids. I have my Emma. You know, her book, Emma.
Well, you know, that's one of the things I think the Wall Street Journal did this, and it's dated now. Maybe they've done one more recently. I don't know about. But they did this survey about the women that were running companies. This would be a decade ago. And nearly all of them were had no children or they were divorced. So you wondered how much – I mean, to run these companies, you have to have – if you're going to have kids, you have to have a husband who's going to be running the household. Somebody's got to raise the children. I think that's one of the issues. We just got an email from Paul. These are two great innovators, Margaret Mead in anthropology and Jane Goodall in animal behavioral sciences. Okay. Those are good, too. Did Jane Goodall have any – was she married with kids? I don't think so.
Margaret Mead was – well, Margaret Mead had several marriages, and she did have kids. And it's interesting. She was somebody who came back from Papua New Guinea and basically said, you know, like – and Samoa, and said, I want to do child rearing totally differently. And she found this doctor who was willing to do things completely differently than, you know, like have the spouse in there when you're having the kid. Like things we say think now are normal, but nobody accepted them at the time. And this guy, this really random doctor she found was named Benjamin Spock. So, she changed so many things. She's really interesting.
Let's take a few calls. Stephen in Boston, you're on with Karen Miller. We're talking about women innovators because March is National Women's Month. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how you doing? I would put Robin Chase's name out there from graduate
Zipcar.
From MIT.
Yes.
Zipcar and Go Loco and all sorts of other. But she does great stuff.
Well, that's a great, great contemporary example. And Marjorie knows this story. You don't, Kara, which shows how women are innovators and not all men are. Robin Chase conceived of this idea when she had a kid. She and a friend of hers, another mother at Cambridgeport School, where my kids went to school. The woman who was Robin's partner, who ultimately got out of the business pretty early, walks up to me one day and she says, do you have any business experience? This is a true story. You have any business experience? Well, I ran a store somewhere. I had a little magazine. He says, let me ask you a question about an idea that Robin and I have. And she says, we have this idea about doing cars and letting them borrow them for an hour and you rent them. And
She came up to you?
This is me. Robin's part. I can't remember the woman's name.
Right.
And she said, what do you think of that idea? And I said, to be honest, it's a great idea. It's got no chance of ever being successful. Totally true story. And the woman, I don't know if she sold out or what she did, but Robin obviously went on to be the champion of this thing. And by the way, it's all over the world now. It's not just the United States.
Yeah.
Stephen, that's a great nominee. Thanks. Thanks for the... thanks.
You were going to shrink wrap cars.
That was my idea. How's that going, Bob? 877-301-897. That's a totally true story. They didn't call it Zipcar then. No chance this is ever going to make any money. So is it changing, by the way, Karen Miller? If we have this conversation in 5 years, is there any reason other than blind optimism to suggest we'd have an easier time coming up with a comprehensive list of women innovators?
I don't know. I really don't know. I've heard sort of two different takes on this. One is the Sheryl Sandberg take, lean in. And she has said very famously, this trend of having very few women at the top anywhere, at the top of governments, at the top of companies, at the top of nonprofits, it is not changing. I mean, and she said, you know, people think this is changing. It is not changing. Then you have other people saying, you know, I don't know, in Silicon Valley, there's a whole new generation of people coming up. I guess my sense from everybody I've talked to, I've asked this of a few people who are really doing well in Silicon Valley, it's not changing. If it's changing, it's changing so slowly that it's almost, you know, it's like snail's pace.
The conventional wisdom is that, and I think the social science proves this out, women are much more collaborative than men. Men are much more loners. Are most of the innovators through history who you mentioned men who struck out on their own or with one partner as opposed to being in some sort of collegial thing? Is that cause them to be separated from women as a class?
I do. Well, I also think men very often are riskier. I mean, they will
risk-taking.
Are willing. Yeah, they will take risks. Now, they may fail more, but you know, in those times
understood.
When they succeed, I think science has shown that. I don't know. I mean, you know, when Marjorie talked about people either not having kids or waiting until they get a lot older to have kids, you know who I thought of who I think is a great innovator? Lucille Ball. And she really created
a
new
one.
And she waited till she was almost 40. Now, you have to think about this. That's in the 1950s to have her first child. Why? She's busy running her damn production company and saying, you know, look, I want to have the first interracial marriage, basically, that was ever depicted on television. I mean, she did all the for studio audience. People did not have studio audiences before that. So she really thought about television in a totally different way and really shaped the kind of television we see now.
You know who's another great one that Marjorie just emailed? Estee Lauder.
Yeah.
Because she really kind of invented the modern cosmetics industry and started from scratch and went around selling things. And who was the second one somebody just sent to? Oh, I've lost
Let's take a couple of calls. Ian, you're in Roxbury. You're on with Caramella. We're talking about women innovators. Hi, Ian.
Hey, how's it going? I have an innovator.
Who is it?
It's Grace Hopper. She's a computer programmer, and she was actually a rear admiral in the Navy.
A great one.
And our daughter, Ada Grace, is actually named after someone that you had mentioned earlier, was Ada Lovelace. And
oh, my goodness.
Ada Grace carries on this tradition of women innovators in science and technology.
Wait a second. Your kid's first name is after Ada Lovelace, and your kid's middle name is after Grace Hopper?
That's correct.
You've got to be a computer scientist. Is that right?
I'm not. My father was. I'm actually an English teacher, and so Ada was the nice connection with Lord Byron.
Yeah.
There actually was an exhibit at the Museum of Science where they had an animatronic machine that would let you ask questions, and her name was Ada, and her partner's name was Grace. And so
that's great.
We're honored to carry on the tradition of that.
That's a great
call, Ian. That is terrific. Thank you so much.
The one I lost, Julie Taymor, local
woman
who did The Lion King and all those great.
Well, how about her mother? Is an innovator too? Her mother founded the. I don't know. It's now at UMass. It was at Boston College for a while.
Yeah,
Betty Taymor, the program on women in politics, which didn't exist before.
Now, how about some of the feminists of the 60s and 70s, the Betty Friedans, the Gloria Steinems, the Germaine Greers? You could certainly call them innovators.
I think Betty Friedan, who, well, first of all, in some sense, she invented a kind of genre of writing, right, that you could write about this, but also the idea of that there was a whole area to be explored that people didn't even realize, you know, was an issue that women were thinking about. I think she's a very innovative person.
She did have kids, at least one.
Oh, yeah. Another person who I would throw out, who is this?
Oh, this is from our friend Sheila, the creator of Spanx.
Yes.
Sarah, change the world
forever.
That is great.
She's a billionaire.
Sarah Blakely. I think she's the youngest self-made female
billionaire. That's right.
Yes. That's a great one,
Sheila.
It is
a great
one.
And she's the kind of person who actually, you know, literally went from door to door saying, like, this is pantyhose and I've cut off the feet. You know, it's great. You're going to love it.
Let's try to squeeze in one or two more quick nominees. Dan, you're in Boston. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how's it going?
Excellent. Who do you have?
Listener.
Thank you. We're glad.
I have Tracy Campion. She is a Boston real estate mogul who last year earned over twice as much as everybody else, and she innovated the real estate game in Boston.
Is that so? Do you know
how has she innovated the real estate game?
She convinces developers to build less units, more geared towards luxury, and less geared towards like putting as many units into a building as you can. So in the Back Bay, she's had some projects where she's renovated buildings and just convince them to put in less units.
How do you know of her, Dan?
I was actually with my buddy who's a real estate agent last night, and he brought her up. And
oh.
Was looking, and she really is very good at what she does.
We'll check her out, Dan. Thank you. Let's go to Rhode Island, where Kim is on the phone. Hi, Kim. Who's your nominee?
How about Mary Kay?
Oh, that's a great one. Explain why.
Someone emailed that before, too.
Explain why.
Oh, I just think she had an innovative business model. It changed how a lot of people were able to do business, the person-to-person sales. I mean,
that's a great one.
Staff, Tupperware, you know, it's all over the place.
That's a great one. Kim, thank you. You know who also, I think, does Billie Jean King not fall into the category? I mean, she's not just a trailblazer or a glass ceiling. But I mean, she changed how people saw women in sports. Wasn't it sort of before that, Marjorie, sort of we're going to watch the girls play whatever it is, tennis or anything else?
Yeah, that was her point, that she could beat a really good tennis player. And, of course, she did beat a good tennis player. How about this one? This is from Andrew. One half of Masters and Johnson's was, of course, a woman. But does that count if you're the spouse? I don't know.
Well, I think it could. I mean, Kinsey, a lot of people think of Alfred Kinsey as a real innovative person. And I have one more person who I actually talked to for the special we're doing on women's history. Wendy Kopp. Do you know who Wendy Kopp is?
No.
When she was an undergraduate at Princeton, she wrote a senior thesis. And it was a thesis that kind of changed America. She said, you know, we should have this we should have this program. It's called Teach for America.
Oh, really? Yes, that's
and
right.
She started for America in like 1989 as a senior. And she ran it for 20 years. And now she is trying to put it all over the world. And it's called Teach for All.
Let me guess. Yes. Are you doing that this weekend?
Yes.
I had a feeling.
Yeah, and we're talking about Jane Austen. We're talking about Wendy Kopp. We're talking about the cancer researcher Paula Hammond. Yeah, so that is this Saturday. And tonight we are talking about sugar and rethinking how we look at sugar.
Now, do you want to thank our listeners for helping you with your work?
Yes, I figured this is fantastic. Yeah. I love the Ada Grace call.
That was great. That was great. Kara, great to see you.
Okay, that was great, Kara.
Thanks.
I'm all inspired now. Kara Miller is a host of Innovation Hub. You can catch her, as Jim just said, tonight at 9, Saturdays at 10. Kara, great idea for an innovation thing. And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we've got Mayor Marty Walsh with us for an hour. Please tune in for that. I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Our show is a production of WGBH. Chelsea, Will, Amanda, and Alan, thank you so much. See you tomorrow.